Well, this month we've been taking a journey through the story of Christmas. And we started in Nazareth, then we went to the temple, then to the palace, and then on Christmas Eve we're up in the hills with the shepherds. And today we're in Bethlehem, and we're going to be looking at that part of the story and then moving forward. So today is the end of our Christmas series, but next week we're going to end the whole thing. So today is a two-part talk, talking about Bethlehem, and then I'm going to move beyond it, and then we're going to have the conclusion next week, and you'll understand what I'm speaking about. So if you have your Bibles, turn to Matthew chapter 2, and then a little later in the service, we'll be in Matthew chapter 27. Matthew 2 and Matthew 27. And as you're turning there, and if you pull out notes and you like to write, you can pull those out, because I'm going to be comparing Matthew 2 and Matthew 27 a little later. But I like to read movie reviews. I rarely go to movies. I'm not a big fan of going to movies, especially in big theaters. I usually wait till they come out on video so I can see how they really are. But I love reading reviews. And so I'm always reading reviews about movies. I'm very much into that. So this week I was reading all the reviews of the movies that came out over the last 2 weeks. And of course on Christmas week there's a lot of movies that come out. One of them was called Unbroken, the story about Louis Zamperini, who was in World War II in the Pacific, and he was shot down, and he was stranded. I'm not telling you the story. This is well-documented, so I'm not giving away anything if you haven't seen the movie. And the movie's called Unbroken, and it's got a subtitle that says, A World War II Story About Resilience and Redemption. Resilience, Survival, and Redemption. Three parts to the story. It was written by Laura Hildebrand a few years ago. Zamperini just died this year. It's a great story, but the movie is only about the first two parts of the three parts. It's about the survival, it's about the resilience, and of course the story tells you the end, Unbroken, so you know the end of the story. He survives, but when he survives, the third part of the book is about his redemption. When he survives out of World War II, he becomes a drunk. All these bad things begin. He has hatred, anger, and you can imagine so after being so mistreated by the Japanese prisoner of war people and all that. And the third part is about redemption, about how he found the Lord at a Billy Graham crusade and how he began to have forgiveness and redemption and changed his whole life. Well, none of that third part's in the movie. So as I was reading the reviews, and they said, great movie and all these things, one of the reviewers, the lady said these words. She said, it was very inspirational, but it inspired us to do nothing. And I thought, that is incredible. Inspiration is a noun, which is to inspire us, a verb, to do something. To be inspired is to be motivated to do something. And she said, it is so inspirational, you walk out and you want to do nothing. And she said, that's what's wrong with the movie. And here, as I was reading it, Christmas morning, early, I'm reading these things, not Christmas morning, day after Christmas, I'm reading this early, before everybody's awake, and I'm thinking, that's what the Christmas story is about to some people. It's very inspirational, but it doesn't inspire us to do anything. We choose to love the story and to go to the events and to hear the music and to do all the great things and to celebrate it in so many ways, and we're very inspired, but what are we inspired to do? The story of Christmas is a story of inspiration to inspire us to do something, and I want us to look at that. We're going to finish the story, the inspiration part, but I'm not going to leave out the redemption part. It's a great story, if I can even use the word, of survival and resilience, but it's also a story of redemption, and from that redemption, there's furthermore, and we're going to talk about that next week. So let's look at Matthew chapter 2, and I'm going to reread a couple verses I read last week, and then we're going to move in further, and I'm going to give you five thoughts in the Matthew 2 passage. So if you're just writing it down, there's nothing real new about this. The story's not new. It's very inspirational, but it's an old story. We've all heard it before, but let's read it. Matthew 2, verse 1. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, it's also known as the city of David, in Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet in Micah, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. This is what I talked about last week, right? Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Now that's usually where we end the story, but it doesn't end here in Matthew. And I want to read the next couple of verses. And this is a part of the story we never deal with on Christmas Eve, do we? And you don't hear sermons, you don't hear in your little books about Christmas. We have a box filled with books on Christmas stories and the pictures of everything. And not one of them deals with verse 16. Let's read it. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, a voice heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation. Rachel, she was from Bethlehem, weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. I'm going to come to that, back to that in a minute at the end. But it's interesting, the story of Jesus being born is a very G-rated story as we portray it with our children and with all the different places and the people and the music, but it's not a G-rated story, is it? With the slaughter of the innocents? That's a pretty R-rated story here. So let's go back. Five things. First of all, number one, this story is a story of light, L-I-G-H-T, light. In this passage, there's a star that comes out of the darkness way east in Persia, and that star through the darkness, and we live in an area now that has no darkness. If you're from South Florida, there is no darkness ever here, is there? It is always light here. More light in the day, but it's always ambient light at night. If you ever go out into the rural areas, or if you've ever been out to a third world country, you know what darkness is. And out of darkness came light. And the story of light, both the story of the stars, and then in the Luke passage, the shepherds had all the angels that lit up the sky. It is a story of light that comes out of darkness. And it's a beautiful story. So number one, there is light that comes into this story. Verse 2 says, for we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. If you are moving towards the light, you are moving towards worship. Number two, and this is important to understand, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. God did become man and was born in Bethlehem. We do all these storylines and we talk all about the shepherds and the wise men and Herod and Mary being born, being a virgin and being with child. But just remember, Jesus is born in this story. God does become man in this story. And that's important when we get to chapter 27 of Matthew. So that's number two. There is a baby born, and that baby is God who became man, Emmanuel. Now, where was he born? Bethlehem. That's important to know. That was the first city of David. And as I mentioned the other night on Christmas Eve, there's two cities of David. There's the city of David of his birth, David's birth, which is Bethlehem. And there's the city of David that he conquered and ruled from, and that is Jerusalem. And we'll come to Jerusalem in a few minutes. Number three. We sing a song, and we always do it here on Christmas Eve, called Silent Night. There is a sense, and people go, well, it wasn't too silent. Well, I really think it was silent. We're coming out of for the shepherds, out of the darkness into the village, and whether it was 6 months or up to 2 years later, the Magi come into the little village, and it talks about the star resting. There is a sense of resting in this story, which is silence, which is calmness, which is an ability to just, there he is. And there is a quietness in this story. It's incredible. So when we do sing Silent Night, I really like that song. I think it comes out of the German background, and I really like the song Silent Night because out of the silence came the birth of Christ. And so number three is the evening, whether it was when the shepherds came or later on when the Magi came, there was a sense of rest and silence in this storyline. And we sing that. I always argue about all the things we do that aren't in Christmas. Well, this is one that is in Christmas, so you can sing Silent Night and feel good about it. Number four, and this is important, is that they worshiped him. Worship was a part of the birth. We see the shepherds, which I mentioned the other night, coming and worshiping the Lord. And then here, what do we see? Verse 11. And going into the house, the wise men, whether there were three or ten, or we don't know how many were there, and I talked about that last week, but the Magi came, they saw the child and with his mother Mary, and they fell down and worshiped him. Now, it's important to understand the word him. They did not come and worship them. They came and worshiped him. The him is Jesus. The him is not Joseph. The him is not Mary. The him, H-I-M, is Jesus. These Magi were called from Persia to come to Bethlehem to worship the newborn king. Not to worship anyone else, but to worship the newborn king. And they fell down and worshiped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And I think it's important to understand that you have two groups of people, and I'm sure there were many people who came to visit, Elizabeth and Zechariah and others, but the shepherds came and worshiped and had nothing to give. They gave themselves. The Magi came and had something to give, and they gave these gifts. It's not what you give, it's that you give. They came and gave worship. Every single person can worship. Not every single person can give certain things or other things, and that's why here at this church, at least, we recognize worship above other things. And you go, why do we come and have a worship service? Why is it so important to have a Sunday morning worship service? Because we believe worshiping God is from the beginning. From the very beginning of the story of Jesus, worship was integral to that part of the storyline. It's not just about the baby being born and eventually he becomes the Redeemer, but there was worship even before he did anything he was going to do. Why? Because he is God. God deserves worship not because of what he does, but because of who he is. God deserves worship not because of what he does, but because of who he is. Do you get that? There's a big difference because a lot of us love God because of what he does for us. We should love God for who he is. And we'll talk about this next week. Because he is sovereign, he knows what we should have more than we know what we should have. So if he chooses to give you something, that's because he's chosen to do that. But he may choose not to. He chose not to give this lady that I mentioned earlier long life. I won't mention her name because we're now on the internet, but you know who she is, and she passed away this week. I would have preferred her to live. But somehow I am not God. And thank God I am not God, because I would make incredible mistakes. Did you hear Joe Biden's obituary yesterday at that funeral? He said something very good. He was actually quoting Martin Luther King Jr. when he said it at the funeral of Officer Ramos up in New York City, who was a Christian who was studying to be a chaplain, and they actually made him a chaplain posthumously of the New York PD. And Biden was there, and others, Vice President Biden, excuse me, I should refer to him by his name. Vice President Biden said these words: "If we lived by an eye for an eye, we would all be blind." If we lived on the concept of an eye for an eye, we would all be blind. None of us come clean to this thing. None of us, except the one who was born 2,000 years ago. We worship him. We don't worship others, because others fall short, don't they? It's a human nature. And I appreciated that he said that. It was a great quote out of that. Fifth, and here's the part that is hard. Herod goes and kills all the baby boys. It's known as the slaughter of the innocents. Why? Why in this incredible story of redemption, incredible story of God coming to earth, Emmanuel, to become a man, and there's a footnote of the death of dozens, if not, I'm sure it wasn't, I don't know how many it was, a lot of babies are killed. And he doesn't just do it in Bethlehem, he does it in all the little villages, because he's not sure if he's moved. If he moved them over to Bethel, or moved them to Bethany, or moved them to somewhere else, and he kills them all. What does that tell us? It's sad, but there is always death where God is doing life. There is always death where God is doing life. Have you ever heard of the word bedlam? Bedlam. What does bedlam mean? Bedlam means chaos, just insanity, bad things happening, right? That's what the definition is. Do you know where the word bedlam comes from? It comes from a hospital in the 1600s in England called St. Mary's of Bethlehem Hospital. It was an insane asylum, and it was known for all the insanity of England. Those who were insane and needed to be given into an asylum would come to St. Mary's of Bethlehem. Now, the British, do we have any British people here? British people, those of you who are British background, love to, over the years, to abbreviate. So they don't call things St. Mary's of Bethlehem Hospital. They got rid of the St. Mary's of, and they called it Bethlehem Hospital. Well, the British even like to get rid of names, and if you ever go to Britain, you can never understand them, and I'm British background, I still can't understand them, because they take out the middle of the words. Bedlam is a derivative of Bethlehem. It's B-E, and then it's H-E-M, Bedham, and then they changed it to Bedlam. They threw an L in there and kind of call it Bedlam. Bedlam means Bethlehem. Now, a story of Bethlehem, which to you and me is just a wonderful story of grace and peace and redemption, is also a part of chaos, because all these children were killed. And it says they were weeping, and it never stopped. Why? Because when a baby dies, we all weep, don't we? When a senior dies, we weep for a moment because we know it was the end. But when a baby dies, we all weep. And Herod knew that, and he had this whole weeping coming together. And I always wondered, why is it there? And I think this week, as I was studying it, I finally began to glimpse it. Can we look at it in Matthew 27? Let's turn to Matthew 27, because Matthew 27 is the parallel passage to Matthew 2 that I just read. The story of the slaughter of the innocents is only in Matthew. The story of the wise men is only in Matthew. This part of the storyline is only in Matthew. And then he shares a part of the end of the story that also is only in Matthew. Matthew is telling us something from this. So we learned those five things just a moment ago, and I want to now fast forward 33 or so years forward to the crucifixion of our Lord, to the Easter story, to Good Friday. So we're moving 33 years ahead. We've gone through his whole life, through his whole ministry. He's now being crucified. So he's been born in Bethlehem. He's being crucified in Jerusalem, the other city of David. Can we read a few verses and draw some conclusions similar to the ones we just heard? Now, this was Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. This is Jesus' death in Jerusalem. Verse 45 of Matthew 27. Now, from the sixth hour, that's noon, that's high noon. Sixth hour is noon. 0 hour back then was 6 a.m. Third hour was 9. Sixth hour is noon. Ninth hour is 3 o'clock. We get it? So that's how they spoke of time back then. It is high noon, sixth hour. There was what? Darkness over all the land. Now that's interesting. Number one is darkness. When Jesus was born, there was light in the story. The light was the star, the light was the angels, the light was the worship. There was this incredible thing going on with light. Now Jesus is about to die, and darkness enters the storyline. That's number one. From noon till about 3 o'clock, until it was the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?" That is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" I'm not going to go into that. That's a great thing, and I've talked on that before, of the forsakenness of God or to Jesus, and that's another story. But let's continue. And some of the bystanders hearing it said, "This man is calling Elijah." And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the others said, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him." And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice, and he yielded up his spirit. Number two, in Matthew 2, Jesus was born. Number two here, Jesus died. Darkness, death. Chapter 2, light and life. Darkness, death. And a part of that death in verse 51, and behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two. It's an incredible thing that occurs here, that there is hope that derives from the death of Christ. And the curtain between the various parts of the temple was torn apart, meaning that we, or the people back then, and I use we as people, have an opportunity to move towards God. So in the death of Christ, there's a movement towards God. And because it tore from top to bottom, it wasn't torn by a human where I grabbed one side of the curtain, somebody else grabs another side of the curtain, and it rips right up the seam. It went from top to bottom, meaning in as a metaphor, in actuality, it was probably God who tore it and ripped it. And here's an interesting thing. The earth shook. There was an earthquake. Now, what did I say happened in the earlier story? There was rest. It was quiet. It was silent. When Christ was born, there was a rest that occurred. When Christ died, the earth shook. So much that all these things were happening. And then in verse 52, which is something that we always kind of never, well, I shouldn't say always, we never talk about it, the Easter story. Like the slaughter of the innocents, which we don't talk about at the birth. We never talk about this. It's only in Matthew. Verse 52, I think, is critical. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. I'll stop there. What happened here? Christ dies, and God doesn't allow death to occur on its own. He does the opposite that Herod does. When Christ was born, Herod kills everybody. When Jesus died, God showed, I'm still the man of life. And he raises people from the dead. Matthew is the only one that does this. This isn't in the normal storyline of the crucifixion in John, which is my favorite book to read it from, or Luke, which is, it's in Matthew. Matthew shows people are of death, God is of life. When God brings life, people bring death. When God allowed Christ to die, he still brings life out of the storyline. And this wasn't 3 days later. That's when Jesus rose from the dead. He allowed people to be risen from the dead. It showed the power of God even at the lowest point of humanity. When the world is dark, the earthquakes are occurring, and Christ felt that God had forsaken him, and yet God is still raising people from the dead. What can we learn from this? In the darkest moments of life, God is still working. He is still at work. When you need that lifeline, little joke of jumping without a bungee cord, God is still at work. It's an incredible story to understand it. And then, if that's not enough, I love this part. When the centurion, verse 54, and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe. Awe is, if I can use a more modern term, inspiration. Inspiration. They were inspired by this. There was like an awesomeness about this. And one of them said, truly, this was the Son of God. Now, I don't know if he was worshiping yet, but he certainly was acknowledging who this Christ was, that he was the Son of God. And the beautiful thing is about this story is, at the birth, who do we have at the birth of Jesus? We have foreigners, the Magi. We have shepherds, the lowliest of occupations, coming. God's calling everybody come, and both or all of them worshiped. Then at the end of the day, when Christ is being crucified, the only ones who were there was John, Mary, his mother, Mary Magdalene, and the other Mary, who was the husband of Clopas. There were four of them there, and then this foreigner who says, this truly is the Son of God. In traditional church history, many people believe this centurion became a believer and was a part of the early church. Whether we know that or not is speculation. But he moved away from just, you know, he was the executioner. Every Friday, probably, he was doing the job of executing people on, you know, the insurrectionists and the thieves. And, you know, crucifixions were occurring all the time. And he stops and says, this is not a normal execution. He wasn't there for Jesus and the feeding of the 5,000. He wasn't there when Jesus walked on water. He wasn't there when he healed the lame and saw the blind to see. He wasn't there for any of that. And yet, just being in the presence of Jesus, he said, this truly is the Son of God. Now, the question is, for us, these are very inspirational stories, and we know that Jesus rose from the dead. That's the Easter story, and we'll come back to that in April. But what are we going to do with all this? So what do you do with a baby born or a man who dies? We get very inspired by it, don't we? We saw the pictures last week when Ryan was singing Mary, Did You Know? And we saw the birth pictures and we saw the crucifixion pictures and we're all in tears and we're all crying, we're all inspired. But what are we inspired to do? And that's where we're going to go next week. I want you to read, between now and next week, Romans chapter 12. Remember, we were in Romans this fall. We're going to end our Romans talk for this time period next week in Romans chapter 12. All of you who are going to be here next week, read Romans 12 because it will begin to talk about what we need to do with this inspiration that we have. Understanding the worship as a child and the worship as an adult of Jesus' childhood and adult, but what are we going to do with it? I brought a leaf up here. It's amazing. It's kind of shriveled over the last couple of days. I was studying this week, and I have to go outside. I'm an outside kind of guy. I get very tired when I'm inside. It's like I have to have windows. I have to be outside. And so a lot of times I study, and I found a place, because this is it's a busy time of the year, and everybody's everywhere. How do you get alone outside in Boca? Well, I found a grove of sea grape trees that had a bench in the middle of it. So I'm sitting on a bench in the middle of sea grape trees. You know what sea grape trees are? The ones by the ocean. If you're not from here, you don't know what these trees are. But they are leaves. They have leaves from the ground up. Most trees have the trunk, and then there's, you know, the canopy of leaves above it. Well, sea grapes are just, there's leaves everywhere. Just, I mean, it's thousands and millions of leaves everywhere. So I'm quietly in this, and there was a breeze. It was still while it was cooler. The breeze is blowing back and forth. I'm studying, and I'm looking at these leaves. And it reminded me of a story by J.R.R. Tolkien. You know Tolkien? Lord of the Rings and Hobbit. Last Hobbit came out a couple of weeks ago. I'm kind of tired of all those movies. But I like Tolkien for two reasons. One is, he was the spiritual father of one of my favorite authors, who is C.S. Lewis. He led C.S. Lewis to the Lord. So I got a liking. And he wrote this little story about a leaf. Now, Tolkien writes books that are 1,000 pages, but he wrote a story that was only a couple pages, and it's called A Leaf. A Leaf by Nigel. Nigel was a man who was a painter. In the story that Tolkien tells, and he envisioned a whole horizon with a tree on it and a beautiful sunrise and just the beauty of the hues of the colors of this whole horizon, this painter named Nigel. And so he started to sketch it out and just did a little drawing of it. And he's drawing this thing just kind of with sketches. And then he says, where do I start? And he starts on a leaf on the tree that he sketched out on this huge canvas. And every day he goes to this leaf, and he keeps painting the leaf. And he comes back the next day, and he sees kind of the sketch of this entire horizon, and he doesn't paint any of it. He goes back to the leaf. And if you look at a leaf, they're very intricate. The veins and the various things that are on it. This one's, again, shriveled up and is missing some of its parts, but he had dew falling on it. He spent his whole life painting the leaf, and he didn't know why. Every day he'd come back to the leaf and come back to the leaf, and he'd see just kind of the outline of everything he saw, but he only painted the leaf. And then one day he died. And only as Tolkien can describe a death scene, he's picked up by the Celestial Railroad and he's taken to heaven. And there he meets Peter and the angels. And they say, do you want a tour around heaven? And he says, yes. So Peter and the angels walk Nigel through the heavens. And there he sees it, the beautiful horizon in all its color and in all its hue. And then he sees the tree, and he sees the leaf he painted. When he was on earth, he only saw the leaf. And he had a very black and white version of the rest of the world. But when he got to heaven, he saw it in its entirety. And Tolkien draws from that metaphor this, that we don't know all that God is doing. We see darkly, as 1 Corinthians 13 tells us, but God has called us each to do something in his kingdom. In the painting of the tapestry of all that God has called us to, you may be painting a leaf, or the little animal, or the hues of the sunrise, or some part. And every part of that picture in heaven required all that God asked of all of his people while they were here on earth. You see, there's something beyond what we see here. Because we don't see it all, do we? We just don't see it all. And God is calling us to take this child that we worship at Christmas time, this Christ that is crucified at Easter time and realize that he has risen from the dead. And he is the King of kings and the Lord of lords. And yes, he is the Lamb of God. But we are to worship him and to do what he has called us to do, whatever that is. And what God has called you to do is different than what God has called me to do. And I am not here to say what I do is more important than what you do. And what you do is not important than what she does. And what they do back there is not more important than what you do. But as the church, we have been called to be a part of the building of his kingdom. He could have done it another way, but he chooses to use you and me. And I think as we enter this next year, 3 days, 4 days from now, whenever it is, I always get confused this time of year, whenever January 1st is on Thursday, enter this new year, not just inspired by the stories of Christmas, but inspired to do the work of God as he has called you to do. Amen? And let us all do it. But first, before you can do the work of God, you have to be in the family of God. And I believe each person here needs to understand where their relationship is with the Almighty God. Is he just a story at Christmas? Is he just a story at Easter? Or is he truly the Son of God who takes away the sins of the world? Let's pause and pray.